Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, Jason Chaffetz and Chris Stewart say that Donald Trump is still their best option on the ballot. Also, as Election Day draws near, we're learning more about Evan McMullen. Plus, the LDS Church unveils its new and improved Mormon and gay website. BYU overhauls the way it handles reports of sexual assault. And a jury acquits the leaders of a 41-day armed standoff at a national wildlife refuge in rural Oregon. And joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Matt Canham is with us. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner is here as well. Thanks for being here, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Miller, also from the Justice Desk. Thanks for being here, Jessica.
Hello.
And joining us via the phone from the nation's capital is Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thomas, welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. And columnist Paul Raleigh is here as well. Good morning, Paul. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And listeners, you can chime in with your questions and comments as well by calling us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255 or commenting at sltrib.com. Let's begin this morning with some news that broke late yesterday, the acquittal of members of the 41-day armed standoff that took place at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Oregon last year. Jennifer Dobner, I'm guessing this was kind of an unexpected verdict. Maybe we could begin by kind of talking about why these guys were up on trial and then what happened yesterday.
Well, I think you're right. It was unexpected for a lot of people. They were charged with some weapons crimes and some, I think it's called detaining or preventing a federal employee from doing their job for the occupation. And these, of course, are Eamon and Ryan Bundy, who from the, I guess now famous, standoff in Bunkerville, Nevada from 2014, where their family was in a fight with the BLM over grazing fees. The point of their occupation was to take the federal wildlife refuge back from the federal government and give it to local government for management.
And so 41 days for, occupying this land, and they were on trial yesterday. Well, they were on trial for a while. It was a jury trial. They were acquitted. Are they now just free to go?
Well, Eamon and Ryan are facing federal charges in Nevada as well, along with their father and some others for that, the 2014 standoff. So, they're still in custody, and that was kind of an issue yesterday in the court.
Well, that's there was a sort of bizarre, footnote to this ruling, and it has to do with Marcus Mumford, the Utah-based attorney for Eamon Bundy, a kind of weird scene in the courtroom. Tell us what happened there.
Apparently after the verdict, Marcus mounted an argument with the judge that Mr. Bundy that she had no jurisdiction to continue to hold Mr. Bundy, and the judge disagreed, and Marcus raised his voice, which, if you've been in court with Marcus, is not uncommon, and he's a very passionate advocate for his clients. And as it was explained to me by somebody from the defense team, the marshals started closing in on him as he was arguing with the judge, and the judge was telling him to, lower his voice and to calm down, and then they just took him to the ground. They took his arms behind his back and then took him down and tased him.
Wow.
And as my understanding is that the judge did not order the marshals to do that. In fact, she,
And he had been arguing at the moment for the release of Ryan Bundy.
From Eamon Bundy.
Or from Eamon Bundy. Sorry.
Saying, he's been in custody for 9 months. He's been acquitted. And he should be released, and that Oregon and that jurisdiction no longer had the right to hold him. And there's a YouTube video circulating now about from Marcus saying, "I was just asking them for the paperwork that shows me that they have the jurisdiction to keep him, and they didn't have it." And as I understand it, the tension has been very high in the courtroom throughout this.
Right.
Throughout this 41-day trial, I was told that Homeland Security had a presence in the courtroom. There was some concern about these militia groups who had been protesting out front and whether or not that was something to be concerned about. So that may have contributed to the actions of the marshals, which, seems a bit uncalled for unless Mr. Mumford was, acting out in some way that presented a physical threat. But as I understand it, it was just, raised voices and some normal judicial defense attorney sort of bickering back and forth.
Sure, with a judge. This had been seen as kind of a, from what I understand, this had been seen as kind of a cut and dry, open and shut case against these guys, that they were facing conviction. This came as a bit of a surprise that a jury would come back and acquit them. Was there any kind of rationale presented from? Is that, I guess that's not normal in trials, though.
Well, I would have to say no. Juries don't ever explain themselves.
Right.
Sometimes they do, usually in a setting with the news media. That we have not. That has not occurred since yesterday. But I would say this: you're still talking about the West. You're still talking about people who have disagreements. There's wide disagreement across the West, at least in conservative places, about, you know, the administration of public lands. And so on some level, maybe it's not a surprise if those are the prevailing attitudes. I mean, I think it's a very interesting outcome. It'll be interesting to see how this might embolden other, sympathetic land use policy allies of the Bundys and others. They, since 2014, they sort of have taken a position at the front of the movement.
Well, and that's been a concern that, let me quickly remind listeners that you can join this conversation with your calls at 801-355-8255. But there are obviously some organizations, some officials who aren't very happy with this acquittal, and part of that has to do with what you're describing, the idea that others might be emboldened to do something similar to this.
Yeah, and I should ask Matt what he thinks about this, but Utah has been long talking about a lawsuit with the federal government to take back public lands here, and they haven't made a decision yet, and I wonder if this kind of ruling will be a factor for them in their decision-making.
Matt Canham, yeah.
Utah's political leaders, these Republicans who want to do this lawsuit, have tried to keep an arm's length with groups that are like this, and so the fact that this worked or the fact that they were acquitted might lower that tension a little bit, but there was still a concern. These are people who run Utah's government, and having someone in a militia atmosphere take over land is probably a step farther than they want to. It's not a huge step farther than their actual rhetoric, but the actions are a step farther than they want to go.
Well, I just wonder if it bolsters the thinking that this is the right thing to do.
A lot of that lawsuit is kind of based on the election, actually, because they're looking for a Supreme Court that's sympathetic. And if Hillary Clinton maintains her advantage throughout the next 10 days and is elected, I think they're going to probably pause, just because it would be very hard to get that through a Supreme Court.
Depending upon whether or not Hillary Clinton is able to get a justice confirmed. I quickly want to jump, and we will get to the election soon. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, I just want to say, so the Bundys, I think, are scheduled to go on trial in Nevada in early 2017. And there's another group of people from this Malheur incident that were not on trial at this juncture. I think they start in I can't remember the date, but it's not too long, far out.
And another group that had pled guilty previous to that had already.
Yeah, I mean, this is always the calculation. No matter what you're charged with, this happened in another one of Marcus's cases, by the way, here in Utah, where there were two brothers on trial, and one decided to plead 3 days in, and then the other, who was represented by Marcus, went forward and was acquitted. So Marcus is. Actually had a lot of acquittals in the last couple years.
I would like to bring in Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh on this discussion. Paul, this group says that it was involved in civil disobedience with this takeover. Is that what this was? And what about the idea being offered up by groups saying that this might send the wrong message to others and might embolden further action like this?
Well, yeah, I was reading some things online this morning about some of the reaction, and like Jennifer already mentioned, there are concerns that this is going to embolden people to do these sorts of things again. I mean, they're trying to say that they weren't violent. And I mean, God, how many guns did they have? Did they confiscate up there?
Over 30 and 18,000 rounds of ammunition.
And I mean, there's been a stream of at least implied threats against, federal officials. You go back to the Nevada standoff with their father, Cliven Bundy, and some of the people that came in to support him, were pretty extreme. In fact, there were stories about some of these people setting up in sniper positions, as cars were coming into Bunkerville from on I-15. And, you know, I wanted to mention something about, you know, you never know what you're going to get with a jury. And you, and Jennifer mentioned this, but, you know, you could have had a bunch of people on that jury who already were sympathetic to people like the Bundys and maybe had some anti-government sentiments. There was kind of an indication of that. Earlier when the jurors turned in this one juror who had been a former BLM guy saying he was biased, and it kind of makes you wonder if they already went in there with that kind of a bent.
Well, hard to say, and I know that, you know, the groups that are sort of surprised by this ruling are still accepting the ruling. I mean,
That's the process.
That's a tough deal.
That's the process.
It's hard not to draw a parallel between this case and what's happening at Standing Rock, North Dakota, and it's something that a number of media outlets have been doing. At Standing Rock, supporters of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe have been protesting peacefully for months. They're trying to stop the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Yesterday, police in riot gear and shooting pepper spray arrested a number of people there. It's kind of a weird parallel, maybe even a backward parallel that I'm making here, because the occupiers at the wildlife refuge and those protesting the pipeline probably wouldn't be natural allies. But I don't know, Paul, will the justice system treat these two groups the same?
Well, that's a good question, and I can't answer that. We'll see what happens. I mean, you know, I've got... You can look at past cases where you could make an argument that certain groups might not get the kind of same justice that others. But, you know, at this point, that's kind of an impossible question to answer.
Jennifer, one thing I didn't ask you is whether or not this ruling will change as this other group faces its pending trial. Will it change their potential outcome? I mean, are they facing a jury trial as well?
Actually, I can't answer that question because I don't know whether the federal government, you know, the Department of Justice, the U.S. attorneys in Oregon now, like, fall back and change their strategy. That remains to be seen. Is there more likely to be a plea negotiation? I would guess the federal prosecutors might start talking about that at this point, but that the defendants will be less likely to go there because they think they can win. I should point out that, you know, there was a death related to the Malheur, and it was Lavoie Finicum from the Kanab area, and now, you know, it's a really interesting development that all these people would be acquitted, and I'm certain that his family is wondering, you know, what exactly. He didn't do anything wrong now, so, you know, why is it that the federal agents shot him?
Well, questions to be answered, and interesting news out of Oregon. Likely not the last that we'll hear on the matter, obviously. Plenty to read on public lands and on this standoff. Related content at sltrib.com. We are right now going to have to take our first break. When we come back, we'll turn to some presidential politics, of course. Listeners, you can join this discussion. The number to call is 801-355-8255. Keep it tuned right here. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Jennifer Dobner, Jessica Miller, Paul Raleigh, and Thomas Burr. And again, you can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or calling us up at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Matt Canham, let's turn now to the election. You reported that Utah U.S. Representatives Jason Chaffetz and Chris Stewart this week said that despite the drawbacks, they would be casting their vote for Donald Trump. He was their man. And that was kind of an about-face, or maybe it's a more nuanced thing than an about-face. Tell us about what happened here.
It's they're coming full circle. They started as Donald Trump voters, and then the now infamous Access Hollywood video came out in early October showing Donald Trump on a hot mic bragging about his ability to force himself on women because he is a celebrity. And afterward, that night, Jason Chaffetz was the first member of Congress to say that he was going to pull his endorsement. He said, "I'm out," right, and that he could not look his daughter in the eye and support a man like that. He did that in an interview with me. He did that with interviews on local TV stations here. He did that on CNN. He did that with national reporters. And it was very clear he is not going to support Donald Trump. And then 3 weeks later, he goes on Twitter and says, I will not defend or endorse Donald Trump, but I am voting for him. Hillary Rodham Clinton is that bad. Hmm. And that same night, Chris Stewart also reiterated that he was going to vote for him. He has been all over the map on Donald Trump. He earlier in a visit to the University of Utah called Donald Trump our Mussolini at a time when Chris Stewart was supporting Marco Rubio. He then decided he would support the Republican nominee after the video. He pulled his endorsement as well. Well, actually, what he said is he said that Donald Trump should get out of the race. And that Mike Pence should be leading the ticket. And then he waffled for a while. And in an interview down in St. George, pretty much echoed what Jason Chaffetz said, is that you have two options for someone who has a reasonable chance to be president, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, and they're going with Trump.
Well, and the question is that a reasonable chance? I'm wondering why they're not going for the sort of obvious Trump alternative in Utah, who is Evan McMullen.
Right.
Given the I guess, the sort of strong polling showing a likely win for Hillary Clinton, well, and that's, I don't know if that's the correct way of putting it.
Polls have tightened in the last few days, but she has all the advantages at this point. She has money. She is doing better in a variety of swing states. So it would be a big upset if she lost at this point. And go against a lot of historical precedents, it's still possible. Evan McMullen becoming president is incredibly impossible. I mean, it would just – you have to
– extremely unlikely.
It's just – the odds are so, so tiny that for them, these are Republican lawmakers who are in this party, and they expect this party to rebound no matter what happens in this election. They decided to stick with their party.
Tommy Burr, I wanted to ask Tommy Burr in Washington really quickly. This is I guess, a sign of just how detestable Hillary Clinton is in the eyes of some Utah Republicans. Is a similar kind of return to the fold, meaning people who are coming back to Trump, happening around the country? Are former critics of Trump saying that they'll vote for him?
You know, first off, 10 days, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, 10 days. I think there's a fascinating part of some Republicans tying themselves into pretzels right now, trying to figure out how to respond to, base of constituents who support Trump and other constituents and their voters who can't handle him, can't stand him. So they're trying to like walk this fine line of saying, well, we don't really like him, and I'm not going to be out there supporting him or defending him. But at the end of the day, it's all about Hillary, and Hillary's horrible, and we can't vote for her. There have been the same kind of conversations like Chaffetz and Stewart are having in tough Senate races, in North Carolina and Iowa and New Hampshire. Kelly Ayotte, the senator there, has been just all over the map in trying to say how she does but does not at the same time support Donald Trump.
So we heard about Jason Chaffetz. We heard about Representative Chris Stewart. How about Senators Mike Lee and Orrin Hatch, or for that matter, Representative Mia Love, Rob Bishop, Governor Herbert? How are they voting on? Have they said?
Yeah, absolutely. And there hasn't really been that much change on that since the Access Hollywood video and the comments then. But first, Senator Lee and Representative Love never supported Donald Trump, so they didn't have to really walk anything back when that video came out and other people started dropping off like flies for the Trump camp. But then you have Orrin Hatch, who say how horrible those comments were, and he really doesn't support that. But he's pivoted to, it's all about the Senate, and I'm not talking about the presidential race. I'm just focused on making sure the Republicans keep control of the Senate. Rob Bishop's been rather silent, I guess I would say, when it comes to Donald Trump. Governor Herbert wants his buddy Mike Pence to lead the Republican ticket, which, of course, is not possible now that hundreds of thousands of people have already voted across the country.
Yeah. It's a competitive race in Utah. It's sort of the sleeper story of this election cycle. Both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump this week dispatched emissaries to Utah. Trump sent running mate Mike Pence. For Hillary, a multi-state bus tour came through, and Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Donna Brazile was here as well. Matt Canham, is the competitiveness splitting three ways, or is this more of a race between Trump and McMullen in Utah at this point? What do the polls show?
So the polls show that this is a statistical tie, with Donald Trump consistently having a small lead. There was one poll that showed Evan McMullen having a small lead. But the majority of them have showed Donald Trump with eking out a couple-point lead, Hillary Clinton, and then Evan McMullen vying for second and third. So essentially what we have is two separate contests. The Democrats have to find voters. So what they're trying to do is just get supporters to vote and ignore the infighting among the Republicans. And the Republicans are largely fighting a battle between themselves. Evan McMullen is brutal when talking about Donald Trump as a racist and an authoritarian, similar to dictators he has seen across the world. Very harsh language. Mike Pence came in for a rally this week, and he went after Evan McMullen, telling Republicans that it's time to come home, that this is essentially an interloper trying to play spoiler, and that if you vote for him, you're voting for Hillary Clinton. So those two are going to battle with each other. And I think that's, in essence, because Utah is a very Republican state. Usually, a Republican presidential candidate is in the 60 percentile range. They're in the 30s, so they've split it pretty much evenly. Hmm. And that battle is actually opening the door that if Democrats really vote, there is a chance that Hillary Clinton could win here.
And which is why we've seen in recent days, actual campaigning from national-level Democrats in the state. And having a vice presidential candidate here is a really unusual thing this close to the election.
2 weeks before the election. Tommy said, we're 10 days out now. If you're sending someone as prominent as your vice presidential nominee to Utah, that's a clear sign that you are in trouble as a presidential candidate. And Donald Trump has struggled not just in a state like Utah, but also in states like Arizona, Texas, and Georgia, states where Republicans really can't afford to lose if they're going to win the presidency. It's a clear sign that they're taking these polls seriously. They're taking Evan McMullen seriously.
A quick reminder.
Can I also jump in?
Oh, yes, sir. Go ahead, Tommy.
The fact that Hillary's sending staffers to Utah and the DNC bus is rolling through there, and they're doing the same thing in places like Georgia and Texas, they really just want to make Trump play defense right now in deep red places. Because they have, the Clinton campaign has the resources to do that, while the Trump campaign is struggling with its on the ground game.
Okay, so sort of forcing the Trump campaign to spend money to get out there, maybe split its efforts here and there. It's interesting stuff. Listeners, join the conversation. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the stories that we're covering today. Call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can put your comments at sltrib.com. Turning back to Evan McMullen, Matt Canham, you wrote a pretty in-depth profile of the candidate this week. He's Mormon, Utah-based, now independent presidential candidate. First off, remind us why he got into this race, if that's not obvious by now, and then tell us maybe the skeleton version of his kind of unusual background.
So Evan McMullen was the policy director for the House Republican Conference. And when he was watching the presidential primaries, he saw a bunch of candidates he could support, and then he saw Donald Trump, someone he couldn't. And as Donald Trump rose in power, he tried to argue with House Republicans that they should challenge him, and they refused. Once he got the nomination, there was a group of Republicans who started looking for an alternative, people like Mitt Romney or Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse. And they were constantly turned down. No one wanted to run an independent bid to try to take out Donald Trump. They looked at it as someone who might help elect Hillary Clinton. So Evan McMullen reached out and said, I have foreign policy experience. Maybe I can help this candidate. And instead, they asked him to be the candidate. Mm-hmm. This is a person who's never run before. He had 130 Twitter followers when he launched his presidential bid. This is really out of left field. But people who know him and who talk to him say he's a guy who would do what he thought was right, regardless of the personal consequences, regardless of the fact that it could lead to ridicule, it could have ruined his career, that it didn't surprise them that he would take a bold step, though it would obviously shock anyone to have a relative or a friend call you suddenly in August of a presidential year and say, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to run for president.
It is remarkable. Well, he comes from an interesting background as well. As I said, he comes from the LDS faith, but he's also had this career with the CIA. Maybe give us his backstory a little bit.
So he was born in Provo, but moved pretty quickly to Washington State because his dad got a job there. His family was relatively poor. They burned wood chunks from a pallet-making plant to stay warm in the winter. Mom had a co-op, is what she called it, but essentially she sold bulk food from her garage to try to make ends meet. He knew very early on he wanted to be in the CIA, so he reached out in high school to a recruiter from the CIA, kept in contact, went to BYU, and then got into an internship-type program where he spent one semester in D.C. and one in Provo trying to finish up his schooling. And at the end of that, he was able to start his training to be an undercover agent right when September 11th happened. Mm-hmm. He spent the next 10 years or so bouncing around between D.C. and Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and North Africa and Southeast Asia, where, according to one of his supervisors, he was right in the middle of some of the biggest hotspots this world has seen since Al-Qaeda and terrorism has been such a consuming part of our foreign policy in the last 20 years or so.
Well, I don't want to dive too deeply here, and I encourage listeners to check out the biography you wrote because it's fascinating. But just to kind of get back to the presidential race side of things, McMullen acknowledges that he's running a kind of protest campaign, right? I mean, he doesn't expect to win, as you pointed out before.
Yeah, there is a narrow path where he could win. It's not, you know, how this would work is Donald Trump would have to make up some ground, split enough states with Hillary Clinton that no one got enough electoral votes to be named the president. In our Constitution, that means the House of Representatives then picks. And if Evan McMullen won a state, he could be one of the people they pick. Hmm. So if he wins Utah, that would be how that would work. But that does not appear to be likely. He acknowledges that does not appear to be likely. And so what he's talking about more is he's a person you can vote for and feel good about your conservative values. And he's becoming an increasing critic of the Republican Party. He took to Twitter yesterday to criticize Jason Chaffetz and Chris Stewart for saying they're going to vote for Donald Trump. And if these are the kind of conservative leaders you have, what's the point of having them? He is talking about starting a new political party, if necessary, out of the ashes of whatever this presidential election is for Republicans.
The face of a new conservative movement, kind of.
Yes. I mean, that to me sounds like a much heavier lift than launching a presidential bid in August of a presidential year. Creating a political party in this country, we have two, and everyone who's tried since has not worked out. So, I mean, that's just an amazing an attempt.
Well, Paul Rawley, any comments on conservative movements in America right now?
Well, like Matt said, there is some support for McMullen, what he's trying to do in terms of people being very disillusioned now with the Republican Party and what has happened with it in the nomination of Donald Trump. And the party seems very split, and you've got this groundswell movement of people who are just angry. And they have gotten a large voice now within the Republican Party. And now you're seeing what's happened, and you're seeing what's happened to some of the down-ballot people who have no idea what to do. Because, like Matt said, on the one hand, if they don't support Trump, they're going to anger the Trump supporters. And if they do, they're going to get hurt the other way. So, in terms of Chaffetz and Stewart, you know, they don't have that worry in Utah. They're going to win, I mean, easily. And so they don't have to bend back and forth in Utah. But I think what they're trying to do is keep their credentials good in their Republican caucuses in Congress.
So this isn't going to affect necessarily their chances in being reelected?
You can put it in the bank that they're both going to be reelected.
Okay. Comment at sltrib.com says, Chaffetz is a, quote, never Hillary at all costs supporter, question mark. This is the same line of thinking that brought about that brought Republicans the Trump nominee. This year's group of Republican delegates need to be removed and banned from ever holding a delegate position ever again, is a comment made by a listener. Some backlash, I guess, against the Republican Party.
Yeah, particularly for these Republicans who said they were not going to vote for Donald Trump, or at least tried to imply that they were not going to vote for Donald Trump, and now are. There are a lot of people, both within the conservative movement as well as liberals, who look at that and roll their eyes. The idea that you can say, I'm not endorsing a candidate, but I'm going to vote for this candidate because this candidate is better than the other candidate, kind of strains logic in the sense of, well, you just endorse them then.
Yeah.
I don't see how there could be any—
Jennifer Doudna.
Like, I'm not sure how there could be any, like, blowback or pushback or fallout for somebody like Jason Chaffetz, who has a very comfortable, more than comfortable lead in his district. So don't vote for Trump.
Well, and it's because it might not have a fallout here in the state of Utah, but if you want to be a player in the Republican Party,
it's about the party.
And you didn't vote for your Republican nominee.
That could have an effect.
That's the bigger issue.
Well, I want to close out the conversation about presidential politics here in a moment. But before I do that, does anybody want to predict what's going to happen here in Utah? Tommy, want to take a stab?
People will vote and we'll elect a new president.
Yeah, I don't have any sense. And when you have a 30-30-30 split in a lot of these polls, it does not take many votes changing to wildly change this election. And this election has been altered fundamentally pretty much every 48 hours for how many weeks?
Right.
I don't think the last shoe was dropped yet.
So I have to ask, Matt, is like this the most fun you've had in an election year in a while or this ever?
I've long pushed Utah politicians to make some sort of super race. I want Jason Chaffetz to run against, you know, Gary Herbert and Orrin Hatch for the Senate, just so I have something interesting to write about. I never actually thought that the close race I would write about was a presidential one.
A busy time of year for political writers here in the state of Utah. It's time right now for another quick break, but when we come back, Brigham Young University unveils an overhaul of its system for receiving sexual assault reports. First, though, we are going to take a quick break and some messages. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jessica Miller, Matt Canham, Thomas Burr, Jennifer Doudna, and Paul Raleigh. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Jessica Miller, this week, Brigham Young University unveiled some changes to how it handles sexual assault reports. Before we go there, though, give us the background. Why was BYU re-examining how it handles these reports in the first place?
So in April, we heard from a lot of students and former students, you know, they started sharing their stories that they were sexually assaulted, and they reported this to the school, and subsequently they were investigated by the honor code in connection to their reported abuse. So we heard a lot of stories about that. We heard a lot of people who said that they just didn't report because they were so worried, you know, if they were drinking alcohol at that time, that if they reported their sexual assault, then they would get in trouble with the honor code because they were drinking alcohol. So there's all these stories coming out. And in May, BYU formed this advisory council, and they were kind of tasked to look at the process at Brigham Young University, how these reports were being handled, and recommend any changes of how they could kind of do this process better.
Hmm. Remind us, I mean, you mentioned alcohol being one part of the honor code, but remind us what the honor code at Brigham Young University is, just for context there.
Yeah, so the honor code, you know, it's what all these students have to follow. It forbids alcohol consumption, can't drink coffee, can't do drugs. There's a strict dress code. It restricts contact between, like, male and female students, you know, when you can have a student of the opposite gender in your room, things like that.
And so this is the idea, is that you wouldn't report a sexual assault, as you said, when it happened, for fear of being punished for honor code violations. And in fact, the Tribune heard from a number of people who reported being sexually assaulted at BYU who didn't report for this very reason. Is that correct?
Exactly. And then we heard from some who did. And, you know, the Title IX office or the honor code office were questioning them, you know, asking about, you know, things that they were wearing. Why was this person in your room? Things like that, kind of. Going from the idea that they're investigating the victim, maybe what they would have done wrong in this situation.
Right. BYU convened this advisory council after complaints from students on that score. In particular, one student, Maddie Barney, launched a petition seeking a kind of amnesty from the Honor Code office when a person reports sexual assault. And that's one of the sort of changes being implemented to school policy that BYU is adopting. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was 23 recommendations. There were five that they're putting into practice right away. And one of those is this amnesty clause. And that basically just says, you know, if you were sexually assaulted and you report this and there was any other thing going on that violated the honor code, you won't be punished for that. You know, if you were drinking before you were assaulted. And then it does offer some sort of like leniency if, you know, their honor code violations aren't directly related to the incident, but, you know, you have maybe a history of drinking or like having consensual sex or something like that that might violate the honor code, that there will be some sort of like leniency for those students. Mm.
Another change has to do with where the Title IX coordinator and the honor code office are physically located. I guess the Title IX coordinator before, and this is the person who's charged with enforcing Title IX federal law, was essentially housed in the same space that that the Honor Code office was, or more or less, is that right?
Yeah, there was this overlap between the Honor Code office and the Title IX office, and you know they have very different goals. The Title IX office is supposed to, you know, offer support to students who have been victims of sexual assault. The Honor Code office is more of a disciplinary office, and they were kind of just overlapping in odd ways. You know, we had some Title IX personnel housed within the same office as the Honor Code office. The Title IX coordinator was a part-time position, and she was also the dean of students. So there was all this kind of overlap going on that caused a lot of confusion for the students. So now they've taken the Title IX coordinator away. That's going to be a new full-time position that the dean of students will no longer have. They're physically moving the Title IX office away from the Honor Code office to, you know, physically separate them. They actually were on the same software system for a while and had this firewall, but then there was reports kind of getting mixed up in there, so they're going to be on separate software. So just kind of making more of an effort to completely separate those two offices.
I know that there were complaints that there was some information sharing between the Title IX office and the Honor Code office. Was that happening? I know that this report kind of leads people to think that that may have been the case.
Yeah, and you know they said that it wasn't happening as much as people thought, but that there was this perception because, you know, a student would go into this office and they see the Title IX coordinator sitting next to the Honor Code office investigator, and that there were some instances where Honor Code cases were mislabeled as Title IX cases in the software system. So there was a sharing of information going on there, though it's still kind of unclear to what extent that was.
Does this this new report, I mean, so it's a report, it's changes that are coming out as part of this report that BYU filed. Does the report say anything about when and how police communicate with the school? Because there was evidence of university police essentially reporting people to the Honor Code office after a sexual assault was reported to them. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that was happening. But this report didn't really address that at all. I mean, they did emphasize that they wanted to work more with, like, community partners, you know, the Provo Police Department, the local rape recovery center there, strengthening those relationships, but it didn't really investigate, you know, what that relationship between campus police and the Honor Code office or the Title IX office, what that is.
What are student victims like Maddie Barney saying about these new changes that have been announced?
Well, everyone that we spoke to, you know, first of all, they were just like really excited about these changes. They were kind of, I guess it was exactly what they wanted, and they might not have been expecting it. So they were really excited to see that there are changes being made. But there was still some questions, you know, that a lot of people had. They didn't really, in the report, they didn't really address bishops, like a training for ward bishops. You know, how do they respond to sexual assault? And so we had one victim who said that was really concerning to her, since they kind of hold the power of ecclesiastical endorsement with university. You know, Maddie Barney said she was a little concerned that there's no oversight. You know, if this process isn't working, where do the students go to complain, basically?
Hmm. Okay. But change is being made, and that's something to be said for changes being made at the university. Paul Raleigh, is this a new day for Brigham Young University when it comes to reporting of sexual assault?
Well, it sounds like it. I mean, this is going to sound self-serving, but, you know, I'm really proud of our paper. And the way we've covered this story and the team. our reporting team that has covered this story, and they've brought this is exactly what the role of the press is all about. We brought some sunshine on to an issue that had been kind of under the radar and had been going on and hurting people for a long time. So that's my comment. I want to give a shout out to my paper, the Tribune. They've done an incredible job.
Sure, impactful reporting. Part of what impelled, I guess, BYU to take a closer look at its policies, and all of that reporting, of course, available at sltrib.com. There's a lot more to the story, but I want to save some time before we run into the end of the show. So, Jessica Miller, thanks very much for your reporting on the story.
Oh, thanks.
Jennifer Dobner, I believe we'll close out the hour with another story that you filed. This is the LDS Church this week unveiled a new Mormon and gay website. This is an update of a previous website. Is that right?
Yes, that one was called Mormons and Gay, but the S is gone now. And many people see that as significant because it implies that you can, in fact, be both Mormon and a member of the LGBT community.
Okay.
Well, at least the LGBT community. The transgender issue is not something addressed by this website, which was a disappointment for some. But the point of the website really is to offer story and a message of welcoming and I don't want to say acceptance because I think that goes a step too far. But the message always is that we love you, we welcome you. You have full membership. You know, it's qualified membership because you have to follow the rules, remain celibate. You can't be married, things like that.
A change in tone, maybe.
Change in tone, and which I think is the tone that where the church has been. We've seen the church go over the last 10 years or so, moving towards a more welcoming space for its the LGBT community.
In some instances, I mean, one thing that's drawn some attention in this new website is something that's actually being left out of the website. No mention of something.
Right. No mention of the now almost 1 year old policy that labels same-sex Mormon couples apostates and bars their children from membership until they reach the age of 18. It was a very divisive position that the church took a year ago, November 5th, and they do not address the policy anywhere on the website. They do default to their standard policy that relates to all sexual relations outside of marriage as being the only, you have sex is something that belongs within a marriage. There's no extracurricular activity, and also they do maintain their policy that marriage is between one man and one woman. So a mixed bag of reviews from people who have seen the website. Many are very happy about it. They think it's positive and it moves the conversation forward. Others say there are still some holes.
Measures of acceptance being kind of implemented there. But is there still language, referring to same-sex attraction, not acting on same-sex attraction as opposed to a person's sort of gay identity?
Yeah, the church has embraced this same-sex attraction and same as opposed to using gay or lesbian because their position, which they explain on the website, is because they feel that same-sex attraction sort of describes a state of being without being a label. And many people, they contend, may not be comfortable choosing a label, but they have this these feelings. And so they want to acknowledge the feelings without ascribing a particular label. They leave that to the individual. A couple of other interesting things I thought. The website does have a section on seeking counseling and getting counseling and saying that counseling is, not a sign of humility and strength and encouraging people to do that. They're also saying that should be a self-directed outcome, and they sort of take a turn away from, without saying it, any sort of conversion therapy, which some have I think it's been associated with some of the church-affiliated entities in the past, and this says, you should never go into counseling expecting some a particular outcome or change, which many people thought was positive. There's also a section there on tips for parents, giving parents some support and some direction about, you know, don't be blaming, don't be praying, asking why, that the you're better off asking the question, you know, how can I help my child? How can I be the parent my child needs? Some parents I talked to thought those things were really positive because when their children came out, they opted not to go to the church for any sort of information or help.
Well, it's an interesting turn of events and a great website. I don't know the exact website. Do you know the?
Oh, it's mormonengage.org, and you can find it off the LDS church website.
Okay, well, and you can find it at sltrib.com as well.
Absolutely.
There's a great deal that we didn't get to today, but the hour is once again coming to a close, and we've got to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. Jennifer Dobner, maybe I will stick with you. What's your underplayed story?
I'm going to just go back to a story that I broke on Friday night, and that is Equality Utah suing the state of Utah over its no promo homo laws, which are the laws that bar state schools from talking about any sort of positive discussion of homosexuality in public schools.
Okay. Paul Raleigh, for yourself, underplayed story?
Well, I don't know if this is underplayed because we had the story in the paper, but I just found it has to be mentioned. It was so hilarious when Lube Dobbs, tweeted about the Mormon mafia and that sort of thing. And then the response and the mocking of him have just been so clever of all these people who have tweeted in response. Let me just say my two favorites.
Sure.
The one, you drank the coffee, Fredo, you broke my heart. And then the other one was of my favorites was we'll break into your home and fold your laundry and wash your dishes. But
I'd take those guys.
That's great. Mormon Mafia tweets. Check them out. Guys, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut off our underplayed stories of the week right there. And I know you've got good ones. Save them for the next time. But that does it for our underplayed stories. Matt Canham, Jessica Miller, Jennifer Dobner, Paul Raleigh, and Thomas Burr, who's been on the phone there, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
We will wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Christmas comes early. With the arrival of October, your mind immediately turned to the panic that sets in advance of Christmas. And we're talking about personal financial panic here.
Oh, yeah. I have 9 grandchildren.
Ah.
They all live within about 500 yards of me, and they expect something significant out of Grandpa and Grandma for Christmas. And so we have to start planning a long way out. In fact, some of the gifts are already starting to arrive at our house by FedEx and UPS.
You write that from the kids' perspective, and as a kid you remember this, how much excitement there was about Christmas approaching. But you have this moment where you remember your father and his sort of reaction to the approach of Christmas, not dissimilar to your own nowadays.
Well, back then, the best way to ensure that you got what you wanted for Christmas was to announce it out loud.
Right.
Because your parents might hear you and get it for you, or Santa would hear you. I mean, as the song goes, he sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, but it never says anything about whether or not he can hear you.
Well, more ears than the NSA.
That's right. And so my brothers and sisters would talk in the backyard. Well, I want for Christmas. I want this for Christmas. My dad, who's up front in the seat, knowing that he has to pay for all this, you know, we're on his last nerve, and so he'll suddenly slam on the brakes and glare at us in the rearview mirror and say, "Tell me what you want for Christmas one more time. I dare you."
Well, and yeah, as a kid, you know, you don't know. You don't think that there's a problem there.
Other than your birthday, this is the one time, the one shot you have at getting something that you've always wanted.
So you hold particular ire for businesses that, shall we say, jump the gun on the Christmas season.
Oh, jump the gun? They jump prior to the invention of the gun. They go that far back. They jump the throne rock. the grocery store nearest to my house, I walked in there 2 weeks ago, and there's a Christmas tree up already.
Wow.
Granted, it had, you know, Halloween decorations on it, but that was their nod to the next holiday coming up. But they still had Christmas trees up, so it's already started among my grandkids. What are you going to ask Santa for Christmas?
Yeah, and it's not even, they haven't even gotten their bags of candy yet.
No, they haven't.
You know, people have been complaining for decades and decades that Christmas has become too consumer-oriented a holiday. Do you think that that's ever going to change?
No. As long as it's the biggest, you know, shopping day and Black Friday.
In recent years, you get kind of more of the oh boy feelings at the signs of Christmas coming in.
Oh yeah, this is the great get even moment when you realize that you can wind your grandkids up and get them exactly what their parents don't want them to have.
Among those things?
Electric guitar, a taser, a snake, things like that.
Even if they don't want them?
No, you can talk your grandkids into being interested in anything. You just got to show them how to use it. I got 9 grandkids, can't wait to shoot cannons.
How do you hide the cannons from their parents?
I haven't thought about that part yet.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can find all of his opinions, the full Kirby archives, at sltrib.com. A quick reminder about the Salt Lake Tribune's next Trib Talk Live event. This coming Wednesday at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, the Trib presents Confronting Rape Culture, Conversation About Consent. The event will explore legal definitions, social realities, and more with a panel that includes Jessica Luther, author of a new book, Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football, and the Politics of Rape. That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us today on Behind the Headlines. We'll see you again here next week.